Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Many things in the world are designed with the average person in mind. School curricula, seats on public transit vehicles, health assessments. Trouble is, you are not the average person. In fact, the average person is something of a mythological creature. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Sure, we can measure different attributes of a lot of different individuals and come up with an average that accounts for all of them. But if you were to, say, determine the average woman's height, weight, and proportions, you would have a very difficult time finding any individual who measured exactly average for everything. My guest would argue that our national obsession with being average or above average is counterproductive anyway, and that we all do better if we leave room for individuals to carve their own paths to achievement. Todd Rose is director of the Mind, Brain, and Education program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His new book is called The End of Average: How We Succeed in a World That Values Sameness, and he joins us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Todd, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
What does the term average mean scientifically, and what kind of meaning do we give it culturally?
So scientifically, it really does just mean you take the mathematical average of a whole bunch of different people or things, right, and you get a number. And culturally, it's become this obsession that we have, right, in this kind of paradoxical way where on the one hand, we want to be average on things, and it stands for normal. But then at the same time, there's lots of places where we don't want to be average. And it's like, no, anything but don't tell me my kid's average at school or something like that. So it's become the measuring stick that we use to think about ourselves as human beings.
You know that averages are fine and even useful in comparing groups of people. They're just not useful when applied at the individual level. Can you explain why those two things are so different?
Sure. So the whole science of using averages started out not really trying to understand individuals. In fact, it was an escape from that, right? And it was really useful to understand groups of people. Like if all I want to know is how, say, one school is comparing to another, a rough measure of just average performance might be an okay starting point. But lurking behind that is this sort of assumption that maybe if we use that average, it will tell us about the individuals in that group. And maybe not perfectly, but at least close approximation, right? And it turns out in this new science that I'm a part of, when we actually look at individuals, the average usually represents nobody.
Well, let's get into that history a little bit. Average as the gold standard of acceptability, it starts, although not deliberately, with a guy named Adolf Quetelet.
Right. So I was really intrigued by, like, where did this come from? Like, why did we ever think this was a good idea? And it turns out this Adolf Quetelet in Belgium, in the early to mid-1800s, he's watching this chaos across Europe and trying to deal with mass immigration and, you know, poverty and stuff. And he's an astronomer by training. And in astronomy, it's actually quite useful to take a whole bunch of different observations of, say, the speed of Saturn and say, if you average those together, it tends to give you a close approximation to truth, right? So he says, well, maybe that's the secret. Right, that instead of thinking about individual people, if we just average them together, you'll get this thing. And he coins the term, the average man. And he said that should be our focus. And anything that deviates from that, he called monstrosity.
So after Quetelet came Sir Francis Galton, and his work changed the game considerably.
Right. So for Quetelet, he idolized averages, right? He thought they were perfection, and he thought government should help to homogenize people. Well, you go to England, you know, about 30 years later or so, and Galton looks at Quetelet's work and says, yes, okay, I agree that average represents the true sort of racial norm. But he said, who would want to be average? Like, that's just mediocre. And so he thinks, well, how do I solve this problem? He says, we got to figure out, there are clearly people who are better than average. How do we find them? And so he invents the idea of rank. So it's purely about how far you deviate from the average that matters now.
And of course, not surprisingly, with the American focus on the cult of the individual, we have Frederick Taylor coming along, who believes that deliberate standardization, making everybody cleave to an average, do things the same way, will make people more productive.
Yeah, that was surprising to me. You know, you'd think in America, we might have been the last place to adopt this as an obsession. But Frederick Taylor, he says, hey, look, we're really inefficient at work in this new industrial age. And he borrows these ideas from, you know, Quetelet and Galton. He says, look, what if we just made the system be more important than the individual and we standardized everything around average workers? And he does that. And the truth is, it was way more efficient at the systems level. It just stripped the dignity out of any individual worker.
And for better or for worse, Taylor gave us the manager in the modern sense.
Right. If you're going to basically make every single person an interchangeable cog based on averages, you need someone to control things, right? So he thought, well, we'll empower these smarter people to be able to decide all the work, and then the average employee will just execute that work. And he just drew that bright line between what a manager was and the actual worker.
So how did Taylor, with his ideas of, you know, using a stopwatch to figure how long it took you to walk across the room and pick up a cog and insert it into a wheel or whatever it was that he was doing, how did those ideas seep into the public education system?
Well, you know, once you have an average-based standardized economy, it's sort of natural that now you need to figure out, well, how do we prepare a standardized workforce? And, you know, our public education system was obviously the prime go-to place. And, you know, it was at the same time where we knew that we needed more education. We didn't really have a broad-scale public education system beyond, like, grade school. So we start to see the high school movement come about and realize, hey, why don't we apply the same principles around average and rank to the design of a standardized education system?
So what are the consequences of that? I mean, because there are economies of scale with the way we educate children in America.
Absolutely. And, you know, if to be honest, like if we were having this conversation 50 years ago, I would have been a champion of the standardized system because I'm not sure what else you would have done, right? If it came down to a few people getting tailorized or, I guess, personalized education and versus everyone getting something that doesn't quite fit, but at least it's fair, I would take that every time, right? But it made assumptions about talent and human potential, like what people are worth, that are demonstrably false. And now today, for the first time, we actually have the technology and the science to do it completely differently at scale, right? But in my mind, what's holding us back is, as a public, we don't realize that average is actually the problem.
I love the story that you open with, which is the effort by the U.S. Air Force to design the perfect cockpit for their pilots, right? So they start by taking a lot of measurements of individual men, because women didn't count back then, in the 1940s, and then they size the cockpits according to the averages, the average-sized hand, the average length of arm, the average legs. What they created was a plane that was a perfect fit for no one.
Right. So that was the first time that I could find where it was a clear demonstration that average doesn't exist, and that there are enormous practical consequences to it, right? So they were struggling to find enough pilots coming after World War II, and we had the new jet planes, right, with all kinds of technology, and we were getting terrible performance. So, yeah, they thought that basically designing on average would create a cockpit that accommodated most pilots. It's one really young guy just barely into the game named Gilbert Daniels, who doesn't even like planes, really. He later goes on to become a botanist, and he realizes that the average is probably the concept of average is the failure, is the problem. And so he gets permission to do this study where he says, I just want to know how many of these pilots that are handpicked because they are close to average are actually average on these, like, 10 dimensions of size. And he finds, like, nobody, not a single one. And I think what's most remarkable about that is, for such a hierarchical sort of conservative institution, the military, they pivoted so quickly away from averages and basically mandated that from now on, if you wanted to sell fighter jets to the Air Force, you had to design cockpits that went to the edges of these dimensions of size. And as a result, we got immediate performance boost, but almost unintentionally, we expanded the talent pool. And we have, like, an incredibly diverse group of pilots today that we never would have had if we hadn't got beyond average.
So the idea is, you know, the change was as simple as making seats that would move back and forth and, you know, having some adjustable components within the plane itself.
Yeah, isn't that remarkable?
Yeah.
That, like, they didn't have adjustable seats. And only a mindset that suggests average really represents most people would lead you to think you could design something without basic adjustable seats. And so what I loved about that story was that eventually to get to accommodating, you know, the wide range of population, you got to do things like wraparound glass cockpits and stuff like that, which is a little more expensive. But they made enormous gains really quickly just by doing adjustable seats.
We're speaking this hour with Todd Rose, who is director of the Mind, Brain, and Education program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He's author of a new book called The End of Average: How We Succeed in a World That Values Sameness. You can be part of our conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Today, as part of KERA's American Graduate Series, we speak with Todd Rose, director of the Mind, Brain, and Education program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His new book is called The End of Average: How We Succeed in a World That Values Sameness. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Todd, as we get into talking about how this affects the way we perceive the right way to educate people, the way we test people's skills, part of the reason that this topic appeals to you is that there was a time in your life when, by the numbers, you looked to be way less than average, at least academically.
That's probably the understatement of the year for me. yeah, so, you know, for someone who ended up in academia, I did not have a particularly good experience in school. It was such a poor fit between who I was as an individual and the sort of standardized system. And it was a constant battle for me all the way through grade school. And it culminated in me dropping out of school with a 0.9 GPA. And I like to say that you have to work really hard to do that poorly. I think I could have just put C for every answer and done better. But yeah, I experienced the consequences of not fitting to this rigid system in a way that left me, you know, I got married when I was 19, had a child. We were on welfare, and I was bouncing around from, you know, 10 different minimum wage jobs over 2 years. And there was a certain way that people saw me. Like, my father-in-law said, well, he knew what it was. He said I was lazy. And in fairness, I don't really blame him. You know, if it was my daughter, I would be a little terrified. But I was having experienced that and getting to sort of rock bottom, and really having nowhere else to go, but knowing I thought I was worth more than that. My dad, who was the first high school graduate in our family, and he had gone to college when we were kids. And I watched what happened to our family. And he told me, hey, look, there are jobs that will pay you good money, that you'll have a good life, and you can take care of your family, but you can't get there without an education. And so I made a commitment to go to college.
Why didn't school work for you?
You know, it still puzzles me to this day. I have to be honest. I was quirky, but it was really probably most listeners have kids or no kids like me. I was a little hyperactive, a little forgetful, a little strong-willed, but nothing that a system whose job it is to educate and develop shouldn't be able to handle, quite frankly. In school, it's just cumulative, so that you start to get behind, and you get behind and you can't do well the next class, and you start to, it has this profoundly negative effect on how you see yourself, first as a student and ultimately as a person.
So people might say, Todd, you know, your story is great. I'm so glad it worked out for you. But we know lots of other high school dropouts go on like to careers at Taco Bell. And I don't mean to be disparaging of that, but it's a harder life, right, than having a Harvard education. efforts to get those students to average are supposed to be about protecting them from avoidable poverty and from hardship.
Yeah. So I think that those are all laudable goals in terms of reaching these kids and helping them. Well, I think we're trying to make them, give them opportunities to be the best version of themselves, right? And I don't think everybody's a genius. I just think that when we focus on average as a reference point, it dramatically underestimates what people are capable of. And I think we can do better.
So these days, the one thing we can all agree on in America is that nobody loves a standardized test, but we continue to pay really close attention to the results. So how did we come to define intelligence by the results of a test designed to ask every single person the same question?
Well, it gets kind of back to Francis Galton that we talked about earlier. He had this idea that eminent people were eminent at everything. And, you know, he thought that if you had high character, you'd have high intelligence, you'd be better at physical sports and stuff like that, which seems ridiculous, but that was the assumption. And so when he said ranking people, he really meant universal rank, right? There were just people who were better than other people. And so he introduces this idea of one-dimensional ranking, right? And so that gets put into our school system almost just whole cloth. And we're going to say, okay, well, if we give everyone the same questions and we can rank them compared to each other, we'll figure out who the eminent students are and we'll give them more resources. But it turns out from this science that I'm a part of, it basically violates a fundamental principle of the science. Like, you cannot reduce human ability to a single score, full stop, right? And yet we keep doing it.
Well, and one of the contentions you have is that, you know, our intelligence and our abilities across the board are what you call jagged, meaning you can be, you know, terrific with words and not so great with numbers or vice versa, or you can be great with both of those things and not have good people skills or whatever.
Right. And, you know, this idea of jaggedness is a defining human characteristic. So if we go back to, like, body size, right, so we figure out there's no average pilot, right? It's because when you look at people's body dimensions, they're not really highly correlated. So, for example, the tallest person you know isn't necessarily the heaviest person you know, right? And so instead, what we see is every pilot had a jagged size profile. They were high on some things, they were medium on others, and low on other things. That extends to every human attribute we've ever studied. So if you take something like intelligence, it obviously consists of multiple dimensions, right? Spatial skills, memory skills, verbal skills. And what we do right now is we just take that sort of jaggedness, you'll be strong on some things, weak on others, and smush it together into an average score and say we'll call it 105, right? You have an IQ score of 105. Mm-hmm. And we think that tells us something about you. Now, here's the thing. If you don't care to know that individual, then the 105 is probably good enough, right? But if I want to know you and develop your potential, it really, really matters if that 105 came because you are good at spatial skills but bad at verbal, or vice versa.
And we don't actually have to be good at everything to be successful.
In fact, that's just never the case, right? Like, whenever you look at people who get good at things, it turns out they're not good at everything, all aspects of that, right? And there's, like, I'm a huge football fan, and, you know, you look at any NFL caliber person, they're not great at every single thing at their position, but what they do is they figure out where their strengths lie and they double down on that, right? And then they can work around the weaknesses as they go. But somehow we kind of think we have to just be good at everything, and it's just not true.
Well, I think some things that give people anxiety are the fact that, you know, you can, say, judge your own kids and know that they're bright and motivated and whatever, but you're afraid that a university won't be able to tell that from the scores on the page. And in fact, you know, a lot of jobs are chosen according to, you know, guidelines that are set by some algorithm. And I would venture to guess that most universities are looking at the numbers first and the individual second.
Yeah, you know, so it's absolutely the case. But what I found remarkable when I was writing this book is I thought what I'd be doing is trying to tell the public, hey, we've got this idea wrong and we've got to do something better, but it'll be really hard to point to places in society where we were doing it better, right? I was so wrong. Like, there are so many pockets of excellence in university settings and in the workplace environment and in education where people are just absolutely knocking it out of the park. But they're all on the periphery of the system because we still have a system based on the mindset of averages. So, like, for example, in the workplace, yes, we get one-dimensional rankings. We think your standardized test scores or we think your GPA is really what will tell us who's talented. But folks like Google figured out, they thought that was true, and they did a massive study with like a billion data points and found out those things literally didn't predict at all. And they found a whole bunch of other factors that mattered that no one had thought of. And with university admissions, right here at Harvard, you know, you think if anybody would just play the game of averages, it should be us, right? Like, since we're pretty close to the top. But in fact, our admissions department has constantly pushed to figure out more holistic ways of understanding the individual in context, which I think is really remarkable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Bobby in Fort Worth. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Yes, there's a lot of credit in what your guest is talking about, but eventually somebody's going to have to standardize something, even if you open your blinders to individuality and different ways of measuring achievement, because, number one, people will be doing the job of this, and they will rotate in and out of objective and subjective, and eventually somewhere you're going to have to establish standards, or else it's just going to be like a big party where nothing really gets done.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Todd?
So actually, I completely agree with Bobby that the real secret here is not to go from this rigid, tailorized, standardized everything system to the Wild West, right? Anything goes. The secret is figuring out what needs to be standardized and what can be left flexible, right? And right now we've just gone all in on standardization. So, for example, in education, we absolutely want to know what it means to master something, to really understand it, right? We need to set standards for what that means. What we want to be flexible in is the means by which kids can accomplish that. So I'm a big fan of the right kind of standards and the right kind of flexibility.
You've talked about a different way of giving credit for what students learn at the university level.
Yeah, so I think one of the sort of implications of this science of individuality is that if you create a system of higher education that flat out just says everybody's going to do the exact same things, like a four-year diploma in a class that's structured around the exact same amount of time, and then we're going to give you a ranked score at the end, right? That doesn't really feel like the purpose of higher education, right? It's not what I'm paying for. And it's certainly not what I'm paying for my two sons in college right now, right? For me, a simple shift, which is already happening all over, so I don't want to take credit for other people's great work, but break down the unit. So it's not just a diploma, but what we might call micro-credentials, right? The smallest meaningful unit. And then instead of grade-based time rigid approaches, do flexible pace with mastery, right? I like my son is in robotics right now. I'm paying for him to master material, not get ranked compared to the person sitting next to him.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll continue our conversation in a few minutes with Todd Rose. He directs the Mind, Brain, and Education program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and he has a new book out called The End of Average: How We Succeed in a World That Values Sameness. Back in 2 minutes with Todd Rose.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the director of the Mind, Brain, and Education program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, Todd Rose. His new book is called The End of Average: How We Succeed in a World That Values Sameness. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Todd, another interesting thing that you touch on here is personality tests, not the kind that we take on Facebook or, you know, in a Cosmopolitan magazine, but the ones that have the veneer of science behind them, like the Myers-Briggs personality type indicator. These can be revealing for people, but you know that they don't account for the fact that traits and personalities express themselves in different ways depending on the situation.
Yeah, so that's one of the fundamental principles in this new science called the context principle. So for a long time, the debate was, is personality like a trait that just sits above all situations? Or maybe it's that the situation causes everyone to sort of behave the same way. And what's been really cool is when we got beyond averages and started looking at individuals, we've started to realize that you do have a personality, obviously, but it varies really predictably depending on the situation. So for example, right now, if I take a personality test, I am definitely high on extroversion, right? But, anyone that knows me would realize I'm pretty extroverted with my friends, but I'm actually pretty introverted with new colleagues, people I don't know so well. And that kind of if-then signature is really stable, and you can predict my behavior quite a ways out in ways that average-based personality tests never can do.
So these can be misinterpreted, for example, in, you know, pre-employment tests that say, well, this person might tend to, you know, fly off the handle. Can you talk about that situation and how that was sort of interpreted? It could be interpreted correctly or incorrectly based on depending on the individual.
Yeah. So think about the practical consequences of not understanding individuality. So a majority of Fortune 100 companies, most federal government agencies, all use decontextualized personality tests to decide whether to hire you, right? So you could have done everything that you needed to have opportunity in life. You could have done well in school, all these things. You get a personality test and they're saying, oh, we're really looking for a certain kind of profile. Well, on your decontextualized test, you don't have that profile, right? And so you don't get the job. But in fact, there is no decontextualized profile, right? So they're picking the wrong people probably, and you're not getting the job that you might have been a perfect fit for. And again, if we didn't have something better, I think it would be fair to say, well, what else do you do? But we do have something better. We can actually create if-then signatures for people, and we allow companies and schools and everything to be able to get a much better fit.
Do you think we trust numbers too much in the era of big data?
Yes, actually. So I'm definitely a quantitative person, trained that way. And I have to say, the more I've dived into individuality, the reality is there's a qualitative element to being a human being that just can't be ignored. And just because we can't put a number to it doesn't mean it's not important. And I think ultimately where I stand now is you just have to be comfortable with a far more holistic view of human beings and talent.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Wayne is on the line in Corsicana. Hi, Wayne.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay. I teach economics, and obviously our free enterprise system is based on the writings of Adam Smith and Wealth of Nations. And one of the underlying principles is that everybody seeks their own self-interest, and so everybody has a comparative advantage in something or some things. And so the idea is to find that one thing where you're better than everybody else at, and that's the way you should move, and that would be the best for society. And this whole idea of sameness or average flies in the face of that.
What do you think, Todd?
Absolutely right. So you think about, like, if you're everyone's jagged, right? Like, everyone has talent, and they're going to struggle at some things. And if what we can do is create a society that does its best to meet you where you're at, help you figure out what you love and what you're good at, and develop that, right? We're not trying to create homogenous people or try to select for some universally eminent people. Help people figure out what they're good at and love and develop that talent, and we're all better off.
I was thinking, too, about, you know, the way that very young people, and I guess you married very, very young, so you didn't date a lot when you were in your 20s. But, you know, people have this, like, checklist of qualities they need in their perfect partner. And so many of us who are partnered up realize, oh, the things that I thought mattered don't matter so much, and sometimes vice versa.
Yeah. So it's funny when you start to think about that checklist of things, when we start to look at the person in context and the things that you care about, quite often that what we call the active ingredients are very sort of non-intuitive or subtle things, right? And so we tend to get sidetracked by the shiny thing, like aspect, when in fact the fit comes from that subtlety of the things that aren't that obvious.
So how do we make room for people whose, you know, as you describe it, whose path to success are divergent from what's expected? And how long do we trust them before we intervene, you know, assuming that something is not going right?
So I don't quite know, you know, the answer to when we intervene, but I will say this, that there's this sense of somehow if we loosen up things a little bit, that if we go away from rigid standardization, that it'll be chaos, right? But it's not. It's not chaos in science. When we give up averages, we find really important insights about human beings that allow us to do things like better cancer treatments, right, than if we would have ever just kept relying on averages. And so when we think about our about human potential and about our institutions of opportunity, a little bit of flexibility around these basic principles of individuality can reap huge benefits without huge costs. So for me, it's about, you know, for example, we know for sure there's never just one pathway to success, ever, ever, ever. And yet we've soldered in one pathway through school and things like that. Just getting a little bit of flexibility as a starting point, essentially the equivalent of the adjustable seats for cockpits, right? And look at what it does for us as a people, both personally and economically, and then we can move on from there.
It's interesting when you talk about cancer, you know, there are some treatments that are found to, you know, they're not effective for 90% of the people. They cure 10%. Well, if you're in that 10%, it's the best possible treatment, even though it's not for anybody else.
Absolutely. And you know, if you look in medicine, I think medicine's a good example. Like for most of us in society right now, there's many places in our life where we've already gotten beyond average, right? I can't imagine that anyone's advocating for average-based medicine anymore, right? Like if it's your cancer, it doesn't matter that it doesn't work for 90% of the people. It works for you, right? And that's really all that matters to you. And so there's places like that where we've figured out that you get beyond average, it's better for everyone. But what's still frustrating to me is that in the area of human potential, in education, in the workplace, we're not making the same kind of progress. There are bright spots, but they remain on the periphery of the system. And that's actually why I wrote the book, because I feel like in a democracy and a market-based economy, public demand wins.
What's interesting, Todd, is that, you know, we've seen so many luminaries in just American history who have not taken the road more traveled, who have done things their own way. And we admire them, but we assume that they're anomalous and that most of the rest of us have to sort of stick with the tried and true way of doing things.
Yeah, right. Once they're successful, we think, yay, let's celebrate them. And then when they're in the middle of trying to break free, we're like, no, you can't do that. Yeah, right. But I think that I'm really excited, particularly here in the States, right, where we do have a culture that historically really appreciates individuals and wants to. And I think that once we realize that we've adopted a mindset of average that is so fundamentally flawed that it's even holding us back from being the country and the people that we want to be, right, that once we get over that barrier, that mindset, I think it opens the floodgates to all kinds of really positive outcomes.
So you have two kids?
I do.
Okay. I guess two is not a large group, but did you assume that what one of them did was what the other one would do? And how do averages work within the dynamics of your own family?
Well, I think probably like any of your listeners who are parents, it's like you just can't believe that they came from the same family, right? Like,
right.
Like really, like I have two sons. They are like just complete opposites in almost everything. One's stubborn like me and you know, and very opinionated and wonderfully smart and outgoing, and the other one's a little more thoughtful and reserved. And we realized pretty quickly that as a parent, treating them the exact same is about the most unfair thing you can do. And what you do is try to be really purposeful in the goals you set for them and they set for themselves, and then you work with them to find the best way for them to accomplish it. And I will say, by the way, they both ended up at the exact same college, interested in similar things.
Todd Rose is director of the Mind, Brain, and Education program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His new book is The End of Average, How We Succeed in a World That Values Sameness. Todd, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.